My guest tonight for our storyteller segment of the show is Leon Saunders, and he is a scriptwriter for television. He's written many episodes of TV you've watched, stuff like Home and Away, Flying Doctors, GP, Cop Shop. But in the 70s, he was leading a very different life. Leon was a sapphire miner digging for precious gemstones in central Queensland. It was a pretty rough life. And it's a part of Australia a lot of us don't get to really hear about and dive deeply into anymore. Leon did not become a billionaire for his sapphire mining, but he stuck to writing, which is great for us. And his book is called The Gaze of Dogs, and Peter Carey has said he devoured it. He joins us now on Nightlife. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah.
So this part of your life, how incredibly hard for you to go back to this era, or was it not because it was still so present in your psyche?
Well, I've been writing the book over the course of about 20 years, so it wasn't so long after I left the gemfields when I began it.
Aha. It's a slow burn, like a sapphire, right? It took a long time to form.
Yep, indeed.
So how did you come to arrive in anarchy in the 1970s?
I was aimlessly wandering up and down the Queensland coast. I'd left Sydney. I'd had a falling out with a girlfriend, and I didn't feel very happy with myself, and I piled all my belongings on the floor of my flat in Glebe, invited my friends in to pick it over, and put a few things in a rucksack and took the train to Hornsby and stood on the hardway and stuck my thumb out and got up to Cairns and then came back down again. And I was headed for Magnetic Island. I got to Townsville. The ferry didn't go to Magnetic Island on a Sunday. And the guy I was hitching a ride with said, "I'm going out to these gem fields in central Queensland," and I'd actually heard of them. And he said, "Do you want to come with me?" I said, "Yeah, nothing better to do." And he was headed for Melbourne. The next day he set off for Melbourne, and 3 years later I was still there.
What did it look like? What was your first impressions of arriving in a town called Anarchy?
Well, one of my first impressions, I went into the pub in Anarchy, of course.
Of course. I'd imagine that's the central yeah. place. We should get it on our pub test. We have a pub test
okay.
on Friday nights.
Yep. All right. Yep. It was boasting the largest sale of cases of beer in Queensland at one stage, I think. That's when there were a lot of miners there. I went in there. The first thing I noticed was that there was a big hole in the fibro wall of the bar. And I said to the barman, I said, "How'd that happen?" He said, "Some silly bugger ran a horse in here for a bet and it kicked out and, you know, it kicked out." So from that moment on, I knew I was somewhere a little bit different. I mean, that's not something that would have happened in the Four in Hand in Paddington,
no,
for instance.
Right. Yes, I imagine so. You're not in Kansas anymore, young man.
That's right. Exactly.
So you go into the pub. What sort of characters were in the pub that you'd end up meeting and greeting and getting to know?
Well, I got to meet the characters over a period of time. When I decided that I'd like to stick around, I thought the idea of mining for sapphires was quite interesting and I had nothing better to do. So, well, the first night a big storm blew in and it looked really, really black. I thought this is not going to be good, and I just had nowhere to stay, and there was an empty tin shack that somebody had abandoned. So I popped in there, and there was a mattress, and I checked it out for redback spiders, and there were none. And then it really belted down. It was when they used to have wet seasons out there still, and I thought, "Oh, I'm going to get drenched." And not a drop came through that old corrugated iron shed.
The brilliance of bush architecture, right?
Yes.
And how long did you end up living in that tin shack?
Only a few days, and eventually I left there and I found other accommodation. I went back to Sydney and I came back up to the gemfields then with a girl called Joanna, and we discovered that there was a hut for sale. We went to see the solicitor in Emerald about it, and he said, "She wants $200 for it." And we said, "Oh, gee, don't know, that's a bit steep." I said, "Do you think she'd take 150? And he said, "Yeah, I'll see." So he said, "Yeah, that's okay." So we bought that hut for $150.
Did that give you access to a part of a land you could actually mine, though, for sapphires?
Yes.
That $150?
Yep.
It was that's on, a good deal.
Yeah. Well, we pegged the miners' lease. You see, you could peg them anywhere on, right, the miners' common then. And it cost $25 a year or something. I mean, it's a pretty good real estate deal.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. What are the names of the fields out there? They've got good, great names.
Oh, yeah. There's Poverty Hill and Policeman's Creek and Goanna Flat and Tomahawk Creek and Reward, the Scrub Lead, which which is where I was in the rice bowl, because they're very small sapphires there.
And right. And was there good money to be made by people for that such a small investment, a couple of hundred?
Yes, there was. In the early days, when it was really, really rich, you could make a lot of money just digging with a pick and shovel, which is all they had then. But then gradually those really, really rich leads got worked out. That was at the turn of the 20th century. They started mining late in the 19th century. And then it all sort of petered out. But a boom happened in the 70s because of the war in Vietnam. There was a big sapphire cutting industry in Thailand, which was starved of sapphires because they couldn't get to the Cambodian sapphire mining field. So suddenly these Thai gentlemen appeared on the Anakie gem fields with an attaché case full of $20 bills, and he'd set up in a little shed, put a sign out the front saying, King Star, bring your sapphires here. And a few of us did, and he was paying a lot better money than the local buyer, Billy Hagen, had been paying for the last 20 years. You know, the next morning there was a queue, about 20 people all with their little plastic bags full of sapphires to sell.
And these are ones people had hand-picked out of the earth with hand picks.
Some people dig with a pick and shovel. That's pretty laborious. But
I imagine so.
Yeah, we had jackhammers.
Okay. Wow. All right. You're on Nightlife. We're talking to Leon Saunders. His book is called The Gaze of Dogs, and it's about this era in his life in the 70s in a town called Anakie. What is the Black Star of Queensland?
The Black Star of Queensland is, I think, the biggest star sapphire in the world. It's 260 carats. It was discovered as a big lump of corundum by a guy called Roy Spencer and his father, Harry. And he bought this in. Roy bought this in, and Harry said, oh, we'll use it for a doorstop, which they did for about 10 years.
Did they know what it was?
Yeah, he knew it was corundum. Corundum is the sort of the raw material that sapphires come from.
Uh-huh.
Sapphires are crystallized corundum, but then there's another form called a star sapphire, which has an astigmatism. It's little sort of needles include into the into the aluminium oxide. It's all getting very technical now. So,
So he thought it was basically a big black crystal.
A big black rock. Yes. I mean, corundum just looks like a rock. They use it as, it's very, very hard. It's the second hardest after diamond. So they use it in abrasives and stuff like that. But then this buyer came from America and said, yeah, I can, you know, I'll take that and I'll polish it. And he paid, I think it was $17,000 he paid Harry Spencer for. That was a lot of money back in the,
I imagine. That was in the 40s.
Yep.
And that's when they kind of realised in Australia that sapphires don't, they're not necessarily blue.
No, there's all sorts of different colours.
I didn't know that. So what kind of colours
a lot of people
sapphire
don't. You can get yellow sapphires, and a lot of yellow sapphires come from there. Green sapphires. I had a very rare coloured sapphire, an apricot yellow. It was only really tiny, but it was a very rare colour. And rubies are actually sapphires as well, but they're known as rubies, but it's the same thing, aluminium oxide. They're just a red sapphire, really.
Right. And how do you actually learn? How did you actually learn about mining and then about the cutting? And how many years did that take you, that process? And where did you gain that knowledge?
Well, it doesn't take very long to learn about mining. You dig a hole in the ground.
You've got to know what you're looking for. You've got to think it's not a black crystal doorstop.
Of course, I'm making it sound easy. That's exactly right. You're dead right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that can be found from surface to maybe 60 feet down. 60 feet down, it becomes a bit sort of impractical. But our shaft was 40 feet down, I think. So you dig a shaft until you come to what they call the wash. And the wash is actually the bed of an old river millions of years ago. So the sapphires were formed out of a volcanic plug, and they washed down in the stream. And over millions of years, this was covered over. So you dig your shaft until you hit that rough wash. You can recognize just like gravel, because before that, you've been going through clay or basalt or something like that, and suddenly
you
hit the wash.
So
you mine that band, and that band of wash might be anything from 6 inches to 4 or 5 feet wide, you know, and these are the ones that the old guys got stuck into and pulled out immense riches.
And did they need pressure to become the sapphires, or they were formed in the plug all that time ago?
I think they were formed as they came out of the volcano. That's a good question, but I think that's the right answer.
Right, okay. And then you also needed to learn, obviously, that they're not always blue.
That's right.
Yeah, but you hold it up to the sun to see the blue, or is that
just
in the blue ones?
Yeah, well, you dig all the wash out and you shovel that back to the shaft, and then you wind it up in buckets on a windlass. And then you process it, various methods of processing. They nearly all require quite a lot of water, which makes it a bit tricky.
But especially there. I'm imagining Anarchy's right. Not flush with water.
No. Especially now when they don't have a wet season anymore. We use a thing called a Willoughby, which is you basically jig it up and down in the water in a sieve. And the sapphires being heavy and the ironstone sinks to the bottom and you scrape all the loose stuff off the top and you keep doing it. And then eventually, hopefully, at the bottom of the sieve, you'll find your sapphires.
It must have been a pretty rough life. I can tell by the vernacular of the gaze of dogs. You know, people were tough, rough and ready.
They were. They were also mostly pretty nice people. We all got along pretty well. It was a...
You'd have to. It's a small community,
exactly
right?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And there was one policeman in Anarchy and there was a lot of people spread all over the Gemfields, but there wasn't a lot of trouble there. There was one incident with a guy who was molesting his daughter and his wife found out and said, "You better go because I'm calling the cops," and he went away. And then in the meantime, the girl, she turned 16 and she lived with a Dutch guy called John in a caravan. And the father came back one night and said he'd put gelignite underneath the caravan. He'd come for his daughter and if John didn't bring her out, he'd blow him up. So John came out all right with a .22 rifle and pumped 6 bullets into him. And this was right next to the claim that I was dicking on.
Did
partner,
he kill him?
Partner Hank, yeah.
Six bullets right. would tend to do that.
Yep. So it might have been a bit excessive, but there was gelignite under the van, so it was in self-defense. And my partner Hank said he heard the cops say, so I took him away, "You'll be right, John." And I think he did a bit of time. He was back on the Gemfields about 12 months later. So I think that if self-defense was worked in his favor.
We're taking you to the town of Anarchy and sapphire mining with Leon Saunders tonight on Nightlife. You said that they don't have a wet season anymore. It's very dry. I imagine it wasn't just tough in terms of, situations like that, but the sheer elements, the heat.
Yes, it was very hot. It would get up to 40 degrees, but actually it wasn't so bad because it was also very dry. We used to go into Rockhampton, about 200 kilometres away sometimes, and do a big shop up. And the humidity there used to kill me. I couldn't wait to get back out to central Queensland where it was dry. So it was, and because we lived in pretty primitive conditions. They did a census while we were there, and we were officially subsistence dwellers because we had no electricity and no running water. So it got pretty hot at night time in an unair-conditioned corrugated iron hut. But usually about 9 o'clock, we used to say the 9 o'clock breeze would save us. And 9 o'clock, the little breeze came up.
Imagining it's not
through.
Like a southerly if you're in Sydney or something.
No. Not a southerly buster, no.
It's a part of Australia, really, which a lot of us don't really experience. Is it still like that? How much is it still like that in Anarchy? What's there now?
Well, I went back about 20 years after, because I left in the early 70s, and I went back, I think nearly 20 years later, and I was shocked to see that all the scrub lead area that I'd been working in was Brigalow Forest and the shafts were in between the trees. But when the machinery miners moved in, these are guys that make the real money. With a bulldozer, you just keep your bulldozer cut until you get down to that wash that I was talking about. And as soon as you reach that, then you turn the bulldozer around and you push the wash up the other end of the cut. And then you process it in big processors called pulsators. And they would sort of weigh their takings in pounds of sapphires when we weighed ours in ounces. And they made a lot of money. And it was virtually tax-free because it was paid for by cash from these type buyers, so they plucked a figure out of the air to tell the tax man, and that's what they made big money.
Oh, okay, and there's nothing left there now in terms.
I went back. These
stones.
Guys had got stuck into it with bulldozers and chains and just stripped it bare. There wasn't a tree left standing. They even mined the road going between Sapphire and Rubyvale. They made a new road and dug up the road and put that through the pulsators and puddlers. So it was pretty savage, and there's not a lot left there now. But it's they survive on tourism now, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
That whole kind of lifestyle's gone too.
Yes, it won't ever be like it was back then, because you could make a living out of mining then. I think it'd be pretty difficult to do that now. So now they lure tourists who come down there and fossick around. They take them down one of the old mines. And
yeah, it's all about tourism.
And tourism, salt a few crystals for them to find.
Yeah. How did it then inform you as a writer, this experience? Because you did go on to work on some really iconic television shows that told stories of Australia, which in this era we don't have that much anymore, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. And I suppose they've lived with me all that time, and you know, you can meet them in the book. And most of the characters in the book are taken directly from the Gemfields and just put on the written page.
Yeah.
That was part of my problem with writing it, was I thought that's all I had to do. In my naivety, after writing scripts for many, many years, I thought all I had to do was put a bit of prose in between the dialogue and it will all happen, but it wasn't like that. I had to sort of work out a structure. But initially, I just sort of strung a whole lot of anecdotes together that had actually happened. So a lot of the things that described in the book actually happened, and I've embroidered them, of course. For the
That's what writers do, yeah. Don't they, really?
We do.
Yeah, well, yes, including the story of a Hungarian miner.
Which one about the Hungarian miner? That's Joe you're talking, Hungry Joe, as he was.
Yes, Hungry Joe. Yeah. Well, yeah, so tell us a bit about him and about this character you've got.
Hungry Joe was immensely strong. I had another friend, our nearest neighbour, called Tom Walker. And we all knew Joe. Tommy had some sheep running on the miners' common. You could run a few cattle or sheep. And he killed a sheep once to eat it. And normally when you kill a sheep, you hang it up by its hind legs and strip the skin off it. But Tommy said, Joe just put his foot on the neck of the sheep and sort of grabbed the skin and just pulled it off the sheep. I mean, that I can't tell you how much strength that we required to do that. Yeah. I'm sorry, this is very graphic, right? Yeah, it was very strong.
Right, but he ended up, he died. He wasn't tough enough for the water.
He couldn't swim. So sad. And it's so ironic that you would drown in a place like that.
But I know. Well, that's right. Yeah. In such a dry area.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they do loom larger than life. And your book reads like kind of a bush poetry to this era. It's a part of Australia, as I said, we don't have anymore. But I'm wondering how those stories then informed characters you developed for shows like GP that you worked on. Did you use, in some ways, almost too big for TV, these characters?
Yes, I suppose. Yes, if you wrote them like that, they probably wouldn't believe it.
But they'd be like, oh, come on, that's a stereotype. Yes, that's too strong.
No, exactly right. Yeah.
But they were real.
Well, I mean, Alf Stewart in Home and Away, for instance. There's probably a bit of the Anarchy Gemfields in what I wrote for him.
Bit of chip off the old block there.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, right. What was the difference for you? As you said, you struggled with just kind of this series of anecdotes and then putting that into book form. What was the other main difference you felt in writing for page as opposed to TV that we watch?
Structure was the big problem for me. And I have a good friend called Chris McCourt who helped me with it. And she read it and her first comment was, you know, this is really well written, but the story sucks. Now, she denies to this day that she is those
She's
words.
She's a TV. She works in TV too.
She works in TV, yep. Yeah, she was a lot better at structure than I was. So initially in the story, the hero, Ned Sheridan, arrives on the Gemfields just as I did, by chance.
Yeah.
And she said, this guy has to have a mission. So that was the main change that I made in the later drafts, and that's what sort of turned it into a real novel.
Yeah, we always have to have a mission and a reason for doing things, I suppose,
to
help you understand character.
Yes.
TV, though, is very structured writing. You know, you kind of have to have a structure that goes between ad breaks, a structure that goes over episodes, a structure that goes over series, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And on shows like Home and Away or Neighbours or even, you know, Country Practice, they have a team of storyliners who work on that all the time. Mm-hmm. And you have to accommodate actors who have to have holidays, so they can't appear in certain episodes at certain times, so you have to write them out in the story.
Oh, okay.
You have actors who fall suddenly terribly ill and just cannot appear, and then it's disastersville. Then everybody sort of bans the pumps and starts rewriting things to try and manufacture a way that this character has suddenly disappeared.
You know, sometimes you have to kill him off.
Sometimes you have to kill him off. Well, Hector Crawford was notorious for. You never sort of left the show. If you decided you didn't want to be in the show anymore, you died. You weren't going to come back.
Right.
That was Hector's philosophy.
Right. Okay, that he would burn you.
Yeah.
So I guess you had a lot more freedom writing a novel then. You only had yourself and your brain and your imagination and
exactly
your creativity.
Right. Exactly right. And that's what made it difficult for me, because I'd been used to having all this stuff force-fed to me by this team of very clever story writers, you know. They were sort of giving it all to me, saying, this is what happens, you write the dialogue.
All right, tell us before we finish what storyline you brought to Country Practice that you'll always remember.
That was one. We had a friend who was a psychologist, and they'd been doing research amongst young kids. And this is back 40 years ago, when the Cold War was still on and there was still the threat of nuclear war. And their research showed that an alarming proportion of young people believed that there would probably be an atomic war, that they probably wouldn't live beyond 40 years of age, and there wasn't much point in getting married and having children.
That was me. I felt like that.
Well, did you?
Mm.
Yeah. Well, there you go. It's a very real problem. So this lady said to me, would you be able to do a episode of Country Practice that addressed this issue? So I took this to the producers and the storyliners, and we worked out a story where a kid at school started behaving very antisocially and destroying his fellow classmates' projects. And it turned out that he was very emotionally disturbed because he had nightmares about nuclear war, blah, blah, blah. So the kids said, what are we going to do about this? We have to raise awareness. So they organised a big concert. And we said, well, there's got to be a special guest star at the concert. Who's it going to be? And we thought about various rock stars. And somebody said, well, what about politicians? What about Bob Hawke, who was the Prime Minister at the time? And we said, yeah, but who would you get to play Bob? And I said, well, what about asking Bob? So we did. And it went through like grease lightning.
Remember that episode? I mustn't have seen it. Yep. I would remember Bob Hawke episode.
So I wrote his speech, and they flew him into Richmond Air Base, and there was a showground there that they used to stage the concert. Bob appeared, delivered my speech, shook me by the hand afterwards and tugged his ear and said, ah, it's a terrific speech, and I couldn't have written better one myself. I can't offer you a greater compliment than that. That's the one and only time I've ever met Bob.
The ego and the glory of Bob Hawke, right. That must have been quite an episode. That was such an iconic show. I think that defined so many of our childhoods and, you know, for so many people, we grew up with Country Practice.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's what writing and TV is about? Is it about challenging people, or is it about reflecting society back to us? Or is it just about entertainment? What do you think all writing's about, all storytelling?
All three is the cop-out answer, I suppose. Yeah, and it depends which kind of TV you're talking about. There are ones that you want to deliver a message on and some ones that just really you simply want to entertain. But, I mean, Country Patrick was a good example of doing both.
Yeah.
You know, it was very useful for delivering messages like that. They needed – the eye hospital was short of corneal transplant donors, and we did an episode – on that, and they fashioned their whole campaign around the episode of Country Practice that dealt with it. So,
fantastic. Yeah. I'm going to try and dig up that Bob Hawke speech from Country Practice, see if I can find
Please
it.
Please do.
Fantastic. My guest has been Leon Saunders. His book is called The Gaze of Dogs, and it will take you back to this incredible history and a forgotten part, really, I suppose, of Australia's history in the 1970s. And it's a real bush ballad and a love story to that time with fantastic writing and vernacular. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Sarah McDonald.